Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk. And we have a big show for you this evening. The Democratic primary field is taking shape, so we're going to do our first 2020 Democratic primary draft since the candidates started announcing. We are also about a quarter of the way through the year, so we're going to give the media a report card of sorts for its coverage so far during the primary. And as listeners at home may have already figured out, we are not recording from our regular podcast studio. We are recording in front of a live audience at the NYU Skirball Center in New York City. Woo! And I should say that today's podcast is actually part of a series that we're doing called 538 on the Road, which is sponsored by WeWork. This is the first time we're announcing this, but we're going to be hitting the road this year. And we already have other plans to go to Boston, take a tour of Texas, and more. And we're doing this all with the help of WeWork. So you can maybe, if you're listening at home, expect us in your part of the country before too long. And of course, here with me on the stage, this fabulous panel, starting with Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver.
Hello.
Senior politics writer Claire Malone.
Hey, Galen.
Hi. There we go. That's what I'm talking about.
We should note that this is Galen's first live show, so I think Galen should get a little round of applause.
Yeah.
Claire always knows how to make me blush. And, of course, we have Managing Editor Micah Cohen.
I hate going back to you.
And let me go.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
The
Thank
Micah
you.
Crowd.
How much did you pay them?
You're that one guy. The one guy.
And I should say, before we go any further, if anyone sounds hoarse tonight, it's because last night we celebrated 538's fifth birthday as a standalone website. And
Was that during Wonderwall?
That was Wonderwall, yeah. Okay. But Wonderwall was not nearly as good as Aqua's Barbie Girl, which if you ever have the chance to hear Nate Silver sing is quite the experience.
Really good.
You gotta have some B minus or B plus songs in you, right? If you're mostly C average for karaoke.
Well, I don't know what that math means, but I believe it because you're Nate Silver.
I do a B plus Wonderwall.
That's generous, but you know, hey. And of course, also with us tonight, the most important piece is our lovely audience. So give yourselves a round of applause. You make this live show possible. As I mentioned, on the docket this evening is our media report card and our 2020 Democratic primary draft. But before we get to either of those things, we're going to revive a segment that we haven't done in a while. Can anybody guess what it is? Good use of... Oh, we got some fans right up here in the expensive seats. Okay. Yes, it's good use of polling or bad use of polling. And tonight we have a special New York edition of GooOp or BooOp. The specific example comes courtesy of CNBC, but this poll has gotten plenty of coverage elsewhere as well. So here's CNBC's analysis from today, March 20th. Quote, a new poll shows that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's approval ratings in the state of New York have taken a big hit since Amazon announced it would no longer be building HQ2 in Queens. And this is based on a Siena poll out Monday that shows that Ocasio-Cortez's favorability among registered voters in New York is at net negative 13. And then they cite a Quinnipiac poll from before Amazon's pullout showing Ocasio-Cortez with a net favorability of plus 5. So let's begin here. Is it meaningful to poll voters statewide about someone who represents about 700,000 people in Queens and the Bronx? Claire, let's start with you.
Well, she's a national figure, and I think that her advocacy against the Amazon opening was pretty well documented citywide. So I think it made sense to do that. I will say, though, that the polling kind of makes sense to me. I think I'll come out here and say it's a good use of polling, because I believe that Amazon moving to New York was actually popular among New Yorkers. I think she got a lot of plaudits on Twitter, where the anti-Amazon movement was pretty strong. But I do think a lot of New Yorkers in general wanted Amazon to come. That was a pretty distinct lane of coverage and punditry within New York. So it kind of makes sense that She got dinged a little bit in the polls, and also, you know, she was out there in the news more.
Y'all agree?
I mean, so if you look, these polls do have crosstabs of New York City in particular, and the decline was steeper, actually, in New York City, where she went from, I think, like a plus 30 in New York City to a plus 6. And by the way, most of the decline was among Democrats and independents, so she was already very unpopular with Republicans. Not that there are that many in New York, but there are some.
Any so Republicans?
Sorry, no. You don't have to answer.
So no, I think it is a good use of polling in the sense that, like, it pretty clearly seems to me to be Amazon-related, right? It's not that Republicans have demonized her, which they do. It's that this was an issue that was quite popular locally. If you told people, oh, what about these subsidies and whatever else, and here are the effects, but, like, that wasn't necessarily persuading people. It was kind of at a fairly early stage of the debate. All politics is local is kind of a cliche. I think there is something where people expect their members of Congress to perform multiple functions, where one function might be that, yes, whatever ideological views you have, you're a national figure, whatever you want, but you're also supposed to look after the kind of selfish best interest of your state and city and borough and congressional district. And people think she didn't do that, and so it seemed to me like when she took that position and kind of took a victory lap afterward about it, that was, again, I think she has pretty good instincts, and I think she is oftentimes unfairly maligned and unfairly targeted. I thought this was not a smart move politically because you don't want to seem like you're kind of throwing your constituents under the bus for the sake of some broader goal. You would rather be hypocritical and say, you know, the rules don't apply to my district because I have to look after jobs, right?
It's yeah. Good use of polling.
Yeah. Wait, so I
someone's kinda, an editor.
Yeah.
Do you think, Micah, that we can extrapolate more broadly about how a blue state and a blue city feel about these more progressive policies from the Amazon experience and looking at Ocasio-Cortez's polling?
A little bit, sure. I mean, Ocasio-Cortez is really far left. She doesn't make any bones about it. I think there's this dynamic in the media where they're like perpetually surprised that she's far left. But she is, and so even in a state like New York, which is blue, Ocasio-Cortez is like to the left of the median voter. So yeah, so I think the poll kind of makes a fair amount of sense. I do think, you know, early on when like this, like, what will the, you know, socialism coming back up become a thing? At first I was like a little annoyed because it's like there's two democratic socialists. I mean, national figures. I know there's more than that. But I do think it presents an issue for Democrats where it's like such an easy weapon that Republicans have. And as you saw in New York, it's a bridge too far for a lot of Democrats even.
I mean, there's a lot of issues that Democratic socialists would hold that poll very well. And so part of it is a matter of like picking your battles, that the tech companies are fairly popular, although becoming less popular. Amazon is one of the more popular tech companies. And again, regardless of the kind of their national view, the fact is that like people mostly thought these are free jobs that come to New York and stimulate the local economy. And again, there are arguments against that, but that was pretty clear in the polling. So when anytime someone would say, okay, actually a $15 minimum wage is quite popular, or a 70% marginal tax rate is fairly popular, and people should look at that and not kind of have a narrative in their head that overrides that. By the same token, the Amazon deal polled really well in New York, and especially well, by the way, in Queens. And so you have to look at that too.
So we're going to rate this.
Good use of polling.
Good use of polling. It's not as interesting when it's a good use of polling.
Well, we're starting off, we're going to make ourselves seem really nice, and then we're going to get into our media report card segment, and we'll see what happens. And actually, let's get into that right now. So there are in the range of 15 Democrats now running for president, and therefore we can begin to see how journalists are approaching 2020 coverage. And as many of you probably know, there was plenty of criticism about how the media covered the last presidential election, both the primary and the general. We've criticized ourselves. We've criticized others plenty. And as much as it may be fun to be snarky sometimes, we talk about this stuff because we think that it matters. It affects how voters view the candidates, their democracy, institutions like the media more broadly. So we're going to spend some time on this topic here tonight. And let's begin with kind of the basics. Who's getting attention? So, Micah, how are media prioritizing coverage among the 2020 candidates so far?
Yeah, it's largely by who's polling well. So Biden and Sanders sort of get the most automatic coverage. And then it's like, after that, I think it's largely who the media itself is more interested in. And so far, that's been Beto and Kamala Harris. You know, like Warren, I think when she announced, got a fair amount of coverage. She's fairly high profile. That came pretty early in the year. But, you know, we looked at this data and it's like super bifurcated. It's like Beto, Sanders,
they're
Harris.
Almost in a field of their own, though.
Yeah.
Sanders and Beto, if you look at the data.
Yeah, so maybe you put them on their own. Beto and Sanders get a ton of coverage, and then it's like Biden, Harris, Klobuchar.
Well, Biden, we didn't count Biden because he hasn't announced yet.
Yeah.
This is cable news coverage. If you tweet this out, as I learned today, and use this as a proxy for overall media coverage, people like get very mad at you. They're like, well, we at the New York Times or Washington Post don't do it this way. They probably
do. It's the
same.
But it's the same.
It's probably the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
It might be more nuanced.
We've looked at the data.
Believe me,
it's
I'm not
same.
I think we have some ABC News Boston here. So I will say I do not watch TV as often as I consume digital and print content for consuming my news, right? So to me, like, I am interested in what the New York Times is doing more than what CNN is doing, for example. But I do think probably like you would have more nuanced and subtle coverage, but it does seem to me like there's been a lot of Biden, Beto, Bernie coverage, a fair amount of Harris, Warren coverage, and like Booker and Klobuchar in the next tier. And then after that, you know, Gillibrand is one where you don't hear a lot about her. And when you do, it tends to be a negative story. That's an interesting one to me. But I mean, I have no idea how you're supposed to allocate or apportion coverage, right? Because you get into these edge cases where, so Wayne Messam is the mayor of Miramar, Florida, who last week launched an exploratory committee to pursue potentially a bid for president. It's a town of 140,000 people, so it's larger than South Bend.
So it's
Bend.
A city.
A town, a small city. I mean, Florida's so weird. I don't know what, you know, but like, it's probably like a strip mall. I like Florida. I take that back. But no, he's kind of interesting mayor, right? He was the first black mayor of the city and like came from immigrants and whatever else, right? And so should he be covered? And how do you allocate coverage to him versus Bernie Sanders, who was second last time, who was a national figure, who was at 25% in the polls and not 0.01%, and who has probably a much better chance of winning? I mean, I don't know, right? It's like not like people should propose like a method by which coverage should be allocated.
And let me just say for listeners at home, we have behind us graphs showing the amount of coverage that Beto, Sanders, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Elizabeth Warren all got. And you can see that Beto and Sanders are off the charts. Harris is the only woman candidate who kind of comes anywhere close.
Then you see
almost no coverage for Gillibrand, and significantly less coverage even for Warren compared with Beto or Sanders. So, I mean, do we see some kind of justifiable logic for what's going on the charts behind us?
Well, I don't know justifiable, but I think the obvious elephant in the room here is Beto O'Rourke's coverage, right? He obviously seems to be an outlier in the way we talk about him. I mean, even the way we refer to him, right? The convention of journalists is typically to refer to a candidate by their last name, right? But everyone calls him Beto. So there's and Sanders has been a figure who was a pretty dynamic, party-changing in some ways candidate in 2016. So I think that amount of coverage is due when Biden gets into the race. He was a vice president. He's run for president a lot of times. His coverage will probably be due. But
third time's a charm, they say, right?
I know. But in some ways, I think that the O'Rourke media coverage is what people are talking about when they talk about amplification of a candidate. And it started in the summer when he caught fire in the Senate race, and so it caught fire again when he ran for president. Warren is actually, interestingly, I think her talk about her is pretty anemic, actually, for the kind of figure that she's been in American politics for the last decade. So even though she's doing decently well, I'm actually a little surprised that she hasn't gotten more play. And I think in part that has to do with her bumpy rollout in the beginning. But she's been a little anemic. And Gillibrand, maybe it shouldn't have surprised me, given her sort of the Al Franken mark that people put on her within the Democratic Party. But she's also surprised me with how anemic her coverage has been.
Yeah, the Warren's coverage is sort of, to your point, like the mirror opposite of Beto's coverage, where Beto's really light on specifics, doesn't have much to his resume, gets a ton of coverage. Warren has already released like 15 super detailed policy proposals. Even before she got to the Senate, she was sort of affecting policy. And, you know, we looked at like what words were most associated with each candidate. And two of Warren's top words, so she's not getting that much coverage. And the coverage she does get, you see Native American like just pop out of the coverage she is getting, which is like, look, whatever you think of that controversy in particular, the idea that that should pop out among everything she's doing is sort of crazy. So, yeah, like, I think Claire's right that, okay, Bernie gets a lot of coverage. You can justify that. You know, Biden gets a lot of coverage. Will he, won't he? You can justify that. The O'Rourke stuff sort of sticks out. And in the other way, I think the Warren stuff sticks out.
Yeah, I disagree.
Disagree.
Shocking.
This is partly half devil's advocate, half real. So Beto got a lot of coverage. I think he probably does get like a little too much coverage. I think that coverage was also tinged, again, in print and digital, fairly cynically and fairly negatively. And yet, lo and behold, on Monday morning, he disclosed that he raised whatever it was, $6.1 million, which is a lot more than Elizabeth Warren or Booker or whoever else raised. And he also was a huge national figure last year. You know, Warren, meanwhile, has been somewhat flat at around 5 or 7% in the polls. Beto seemed to instantly jump up to 10 or 11%. And so I think one could argue that, like, policy is great, but, like, we went by a heuristic of, like, how many words about policy do you write, then Andrew Yang would win, right? Andrew Yang, see, now he's penetrating the mainstream discourse.
Well,
this audience
is
not mainstream, okay. to be clear.
Influencers. But he literally has a position, for example, we learned yesterday on male circumcision, you know? It's a little TMI, a little too much information for me about, like, how many policies a candidate should have. And so I don't know. Like, I don't know, like, you know, one heuristic is that you should apportion coverage in proportion to what chance candidate has of winning, right? One heuristic is make it all equal, you know, and one could be like, okay, let's kind of do it in proportion to, like, the candidate's credentials and kind of how substantive they are, which seems the most wishy-washy, and sometimes, like, subjective is fine. I mean, sometimes a subjective doing it by feel is better than a bullshit objective definition.
Wait, so what's your argument? That it was deserved?
The argument is that the argument, you know,
because of the fundraising?
The argument that Beto is overhyped would have sounded better if he had raised $1.6 million and not $6.1 million.
So that's
right,
the standard.
But it's cyclical. It goes back to why did he get the initial coverage during the Senate race that propelled him to the presidency in some ways?
And why did he make all that money?
Because
he had all the media coverage.
I don't think he got a ton of coverage at first because, first of all, there were not that many.
He's been a national figure for like 7 months. I mean, truly, as a person in the news, he has not been in here for that long, and his amplification in the country has a lot to do with media. So I think that's what people think about when they talk about the...
Well, why does AOC get all this coverage? I mean, I think she's more talented than him, frankly, to be honest. But, like, she becomes a symbol of the moment.
Sure. I think you're right. Like, I think he's getting deserved attention for the amount of money he's raised. But I think, again, going back to how did he get a national platform to raise all the money, people will point back to, and I think some of this will go into a little bit of gender dynamics of campaigning, that women are generally overqualified when they run for office, right? They've had more career experience. Someone like Elizabeth Warren, for instance, who was a bankruptcy expert, came into Washington during 2008 as a person tied up in the sort of nitty-gritty of TARP. And then you have O'Rourke, who has a viral speech about a pretty important topic in American life, yes, but that skyrockets him to national fame. So I think it goes back for people to the equity of how we think about candidates. And we have to be, I think, honest with ourselves about why we view certain people certain ways. And I think it was Peter Beinart who wrote a really good piece about Warren, I don't know how long ago.
Around the time that she announced her exploratory committee.
Right, where he said we have to think about not just the number of negative stories around Warren, but what the sort of inherent structural biases are against a woman running for president. So it's a layers on layers thing.
Yeah. You know, the 2020 Democratic primary field, it's got a lot of white men in it, but it's also more diverse than any primary field we've ever had as a country before. And so we're going to be able to see what it's like to run as many different kinds of candidates, and we're going to get to see how the press covers all those different kinds of candidates. So far, at this point, do we feel like we've noticed particular biases in the press with regards to how they cover the different candidates? I mean, we've talked a little bit about the difference between Warren and Beto. Do we think this is ultimately an issue of Warren being a woman and Beto being a man? Do we think that there are other racial dynamics at play in terms of who gets covered? Have we noticed that the press is exhibiting biases that we should be on the lookout for?
We should measure this. It's probably measurable. It feels like the press tries a little bit harder for negative angles into female candidates. I don't know.
This has been measured. I have data in front of me.
Well, give me the data,
dude. Out.
Well, so if we look at 2016, for example, I think people are usually surprised to find this out, that over the course of the entire campaign, Hillary Clinton actually received more negative press coverage than Donald Trump. And this is a study that was done by Harvard's Shorenstein Center, which is kind of, you know, who we always look to for media analysis. I mean, we also, our colleague Meredith Conroy, who is an academic who looks into how the media covers women candidates, basically provided us with a whole bunch of research, which we'll hopefully be publishing on our site soon, which says of the 12 women who have run for president in the past, we can quantitatively show that they get more negative coverage. Another issue is also that we can show that generally when women run for office, they're more qualified. And so what ends up happening as a result is that they have longer records, these deeper backgrounds that can be mined for negative things, right? Like Kamala Harris had to be a prosecutor in order to be criticized for being a prosecutor. And so, yeah, we are able to measure these things. And I think we do know in general that they exist.
I mean, I do think, like, Gillibrand is an interesting case. I mean, the problem with, like, going on a one-by-one basis, like, you could say, okay, Elizabeth Warren, there's a lot of negative coverage about the DNA test claims of Native American ancestry. And you can bring that up and say, this seems like overkill to me. And I have said that on Twitter. And people will say, well, this is actually pretty serious. And indigenous groups, which are part of the Democratic coalition, think it was handled really poorly. And, like, at the very least, the optics, whatever that means, were poor, right? Or with Klobuchar, it's like, well, abusing staffers shouldn't be tolerated. And yes, it's tolerated for men, but it shouldn't be in the first place. And so, you know, Gillibrand, the kind of charges against her seem kind of dumb.
I mean, are you talking about the Franken ones or the most recent ones with her staff?
Well, there is that. No, I mean the Franken one mostly, right? Like that somehow, like, it reverberates around where kind of she gets blamed by a lot of Democrats for Al Franken's problems, where she gets this kind of reputation as being like a flip-flopper and very ambitious. That term can be very gendered sometimes. And, like, I don't know, right? Like, I can't quite figure out why, like, her polling and her coverage is so kind of anemic, and when it does occur, so negative.
I think all of the major stories about the women candidates, Klobuchar and the abuse of her staff, Gillibrand and the Franken stuff and her own staff sexual harassment things, Harris with, you know, the prosecutorial stuff, those are all valid stories in a presidential campaign. We should cover them. I think the sort of harder part is how much they're amplified, what the little things and stories are that happen, what the chatter that happens when you're at a bar or something. And I think all that has to do with the fact that, in general, people, when they're looking at a woman in public life, a professional woman, there's more of a curiosity about their personality and their personal life. Like, you'll often hear, like, women authors interviewed or professional women interviewed, and they say, how do you do it all? Like, how do you balance your work and your kids? And, in the past couple of years, the comeback line has been, why don't you ask male authors that, like, how they do it? And I think that there is, to some degree, that going on the, you know, public life level of running for president, which is, wait, what's her personality like? This is interesting. Like, she's doing something that most women don't do or haven't historically done. So I'm interested in the kind of personality she is. And it leads to these different, I think, a different tonality when you talk about women candidates, because I think, like, we all live in the real world. It's not something that's particularly historic. And, you know, like, this is a new thing for women to run for president in this way, with the sort of ease of saying, like, yeah, I'm going to go into this and do it. Not ease, but, you know, like, they're just going to announce. It's not like this crazy story now. And I think we're just grappling with a phenomenon that we see in everyday life of, like, how do they do it? And what's up with them that makes them do it? Because with men, it's like, you kind of understand that there's probably a support system.
I don't have any kids.
He's single, ladies.
Oh, this is that part of the show.
Those were not. Yeah.
No, it won't be.
Not if you're Andrew Yang.
Okay. I didn't hear that. I didn't hear that.
Oh boy.
He said no.
Oh boy.
What did he say?
Oh. I'll have to debate whether or not that one's going to be cut later.
That's the cold open right there. Yeah. I don't want to follow that now. I kind of forget what I was going to say.
I think one thing you could say is that these decisions are like, they're not exactly kind of made in like smoke-filled rooms anymore, and they're not some grand conspiracy. They're all kind of people kind of acting in consensus in real time. So the fact that you have biases in the consensus of like journalists who are making these decisions, the ranks of editors and publishers and writers and reporters and whatever else, right? And those biases are toward underrepresentation of women in newsrooms, underrepresentation of minorities, underrepresentation of people from the middle of the country, / overeducatedness, I guess, like that's certainly relevant.
Again, my overall caveat, if you're running for president, journalistically, we should be rigorous in our reporting on you, regardless of your sex, but yes.
Yeah, part of the issue here, and I think you were getting at this, Claire, is like what really matters here is everything in aggregate. You know, I, as an editor, received and approved more pitches on Beto's announcement than on anybody else's announcement. Not because I was like, okay, we have to have tons of Beto coverage, or that any particular writer or member of our interactive team or whoever was like, okay, we have to have a lot of Beto coverage. It just kind of happened to the point where I had to be like, okay, let's now kind of tamp this down a bit. So that's happening like within newsrooms and then across newsrooms. And then you end up with this thing where all of a sudden, you know, we've spent all of 2016 talking about Clinton's email, even though nobody was like, hey, let's spend all of 2016 talking about Clinton's email. It just kind of happens, and it which makes it really hard to change.
Yeah, and I just think one small thing as an example of what we're, you know, maybe to go back to the Peter Beinart thing of like, let's be conscious of coverage and inherent biases. So I do think the electability thing is going to be a huge component in the Democratic primary. And often that's a euphemism for, do Democrats just want to elect a white man like every other time? And so people should have to, like, I think that is a legitimate discussion to say, like, well, wait, how do voters actually feel about voting for a woman, voting for a black woman, whatever it is, right? But then you also have to think about, like, okay, well, what's the flip side of that? Like, who are the people that they're supporting? And that maybe there is this bias towards, as we said before, in every election ever, towards negative coverage. What's their problem? What's their hurdle? Because you kind of feel like a little bit of a wuss if you write, like, the rah-rah, like, these are their supporters' stories. But it's also an informative exercise.
It's why I go back to the voters. It's like, if you look at their favorable ratings, Warren doesn't have good favorable ratings. It's like not, yeah. That's not, you know, some made up thing. But what do those favorable ratings mean, right? Does it mean that there's something wrong with Warren? Or is it like, okay, Warren as a woman running has certain characteristics that sexist voters don't like? That question usually isn't explored in coverage. It's just like, Warren has bad favorable ratings. I think part of Beinart's part was like, it should at least raise the question of like, well, why is this? We saw the same thing with Clinton, et cetera.
So I want to make sure that we have plenty of time for our 2020 draft, but I do want to share a couple more charts as we wrap up, and maybe we can come to some kind of assessment. Maybe we'll ask you to actually give the media a letter grade so far, but okay.
We should give ourselves a grade, too.
So what's on the slideshow behind us right now basically shows that the media has a bias towards negative coverage that's been increasing over time. You know, in the 60s, press coverage of the election was more positive than negative. Most recently, press coverage was 71% negative, right? I mean, that's something to consider. And then also, how much of the coverage is horse race versus everything else? And as you can see on the pie chart behind us, horse race in 2016 was 42% of the coverage, the plurality of the coverage.
And so low.
Policy?
I'm just kidding.
10%. So I know, Nate, you have opinions on this, but are we doing it right? Are we being too negative? Are we focusing too much on the horse race? Do we need to course correct for 2020?
Can I make a point about the positive-negative coverage? I mean, the American press used to cover up that the president had a serious illness. used to, like, there are things that the American press used to do out of sort of polite society kind of things, like, especially in Washington journalism, everyone kind of, like, drank together and socialized together, and there was a lot of polite coverage. So I think in some ways it's gotten tougher, probably since Watergate, and so that makes a little bit of sense to me that there's been an uptick.
It's not a total bad thing,
right,
that the press is a little more skeptical. Yeah.
Yeah, look, I think our view, you know, we don't obviously have any problem with horse race coverage. I do think there are times when good horse race coverage would involve having less of it because there's not that much to say, right? There is not that much to say right now about, like, although we're going to have a draft, so we're going to undermine that whole thesis, right?
Hypocrites.
But, like, not that much changes from day to day. A new poll coming out in Iowa in March should not materially reshape your view of the Democratic race. It might at the margin over the course of a few polls. And obviously when a candidate debuts or announces, then it becomes a bit more interesting. But, like, you know, the horse race coverage is basically like, hey, we don't know what's going to happen, right? Probably the candidates who are up in the polls have a somewhat higher chance.
People come to us every week on Mondays just to hear us say, hey, we don't know what's going to happen.
Well, but no, the flip side of it being like, if, you know, when we were late in 2018, we had like all these interesting Senate and House and gubernatorial races, right? I think we got annoyed that there was, like, frankly, like, not more horse race coverage. You know, look, I do think that good horse race coverage is in the public interest, that if you ask voters, do you care about who will beat Trump, Democrats say, we do care about that a lot, depending on the way the question is phrased. They may or may not care about that more than orthodoxy on the policy positions. You know, I hope we don't get to the point where every candidate has to have a 30-point PDF about their plan on male circumcision or something like that. But, like, I think a candidate should...
He's against it, by the way.
Did
we mention that? Yeah.
Nay?
Okay. Cut that part out.
Oh, yeah.
But I do think people who, like, criticize what the media is doing should propose some alternatives, right? To me, it seems like there is quite a bit of policy coverage. And the thing about policy is that we talk about how the horse race does not change that much from day to day. You know, Elizabeth Warren's tax plan does not change at all from day to day. And so one thing about news, you're looking at not just like the stock, but also the flow and how things are shifting from day to day. And it seems like the coverage is actually quite wonky in a lot of ways. And there is a lot of detailed discussion about policy and whatever else. And so I don't know, you know, maybe it's just kind of less coverage of politics and more of the NBA or something. I don't know. That'd be cool with me.
This is verged into like an editorial meeting.
Yeah, it's like, okay. There's a way to do horse race coverage where it's like, one, not divorced from policy totally, but also like not totally about the horse race. I mean, okay, right now Sanders and Biden are leading the polls. Well, why is that? You know, is it certain policies that the two support? Is it more about some ephemeral persona and the image they have? Is it ideological versus issues versus policy? Like, you can do all that, I think, on a national level and state by state, and it's like gets around the issue of just sort of like covering politics as if it was the NBA. So in our view, it's sort of like, okay, do horse race coverage, but don't do a lot of it. So like whatever, you know, get that down to like 10% or something and just do it much better. We think better is like our way to do it. It does raise the question, which I think Nate got at, was like, okay, well then what does campaign coverage look like? Because a lot of the non-horse race coverage is like about character and these like really nebulous sort of controversies that I don't think is very good or useful. So then it's, are we just like covering policies and white papers, and voters don't care about that stuff. So like, who are we doing it for? Are we doing it just to like so we feel good about ourselves as journalists? And we're like, well, I'm not one of those horse race reporters. You know, I cover the big issues.
It's about power. Sorry, like
yeah.
That's what horse race is. Like
yeah.
Horse race that isn't gross and soulless is about covering power politics smartly and it's reflecting people's views and trying to extrapolate why people feel that way.
All right, so we're going to move on to our Democratic primary draft. And before we do that, though, I'm going to ask you to lay down markers. At this point in the campaign, what letter grade would you give the media at this point, Nate Silver?
And ourselves.
No, this is going to end up looking really bad because it's going to be like the media F us A.
Well, That does look bad. So, you know, if he does it.
No, look, I think we've done a good job about...
No. This is not analysis. This okay. is just...
This is gross horse race.
Letter
good hosting. Good hosting.
I would give us a B plus and the media a B slash B minus.
Okay. So wow. We're not doing much better than the media. No, I'm kidding. All right, Claire, what do you think?
I'd give the media a C, and I guess I'd give us like a B.
Yeah, I'd go like...
I think we had a lot of Beto coverage that wasn't... that was.
Okay, I copped to that.
I know. No. I've made an enemy.
Did you
of my
write any Beto pieces?
I wrote the theory of the case.
That's
for Beto.
Right. Yeah, Nate's working on one more right now.
See,
actually.
this is a little gratuitous.
It's become less about Beto and more about the field, though.
All right. What do you think, Micah?
Yeah, I'm closer where Claire is. I think it's like C minus media. The thing is, we have a much easier job than the media at large. It's much easier to cover the horse race than it is to cover the whole campaign. So we're grading ourselves on a curve here. But yeah, I'd say like. B plus, A minus, A.
All right, let's move on. And before we get to that primary draft, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. WeWork was born 9 years ago here in New York City with a single location on the corner of Lafayette and Grand, just a few blocks away from here. They now have over 50 workspaces to choose from across 3 boroughs, and they're growing all the time. And for New Yorkers here tonight, they've got exciting new NYC locations opening up this year, including One Gotham Center at Queens Plaza and Dock 72 at Brooklyn Navy Yard. WeWork's flexible agreements, starting from month to month, can be tailored to suit the workspace needs for any company, size, or industry. For example, their newest product, HQ by WeWork, is a fully built-out private floor that comes with a range of customizable options to make the space truly your own. Their workspaces, of course, can even be tailored to recording podcasts, which is what we will be doing throughout this year as we hit the road. You can work where you want, when you want, but stay who you are. WeWork's on-site team will make moving in a breeze and ensure minimal disruption to your team's workflow. All day-to-day operational needs like IT, maintenance, and cleaning are handled by WeWork, allowing you to focus 100% of your time building the future of your business. Head to WeWork.com to find out a location near you or learn more about WeWork's custom workspace solutions for larger teams.
Well read, Galen. Are there people up in the balcony?
Yes.
Wow.
All right. And now, of course, the most fun part of the evening, our 2020 Democratic primary draft.
People are like, we had to sit through that other stuff to get to get
to. We wanted to an auction instead of a draft, but.
No, I didn't
allow that. You wanted to do that.
I wanted to.
Okay, the way this works is we are drafting the candidates who we think will have the best shot of winning the Democratic primary. We're not drafting candidates who we think will win the presidency, just to be clear. We'll go in order from me to Nate or from Nate to me. Okay.
Start with Nate. He's the editor-in-chief.
Yeah.
We all had to write down.
Yeah, there are too many candidates.
There are too many candidates. We all have like our own notes.
Nate, you start.
Bad pick.
So I will take Zion Williamson, power forward.
So. How long you been waiting to okay. do that?
I would take Kamala Harris with the number one pick. I don't think it's obvious who the number one pick is by any means, which is kind of why I would actually have preferred we're doing Snake to be 4 or 5, I think. But look, if you look at the kind of overall multifaceted set of things that we would look at, it seems like she has a very broad potential coalition that involves voters who are pretty liberal, voters who are less liberal, that is multi-ethnic. She is a woman, which actually helped a lot in 2018. Her favorable ratings are pretty good, even though she's not the first choice of that many voters. Her press coverage is, I think, been both higher in volume and more friendly than like it has been for Warren, for example. She has a fair number of endorsements, so quite a few of them are from California, but still I think she's tied for first in our endorsement tracker. So, you know, solid all around. I don't think anyone has more than like a 20 or 25% chance, so you'd probably be wrong. But I think if I'm like, who do I have the fewest negatives, the fewest reasons why I'm like, can they really win? I think she qualifies, and she does kind of stand out.
So, I mean, Harris is clearly a top-tier candidate. You know, in that media chart, one of the really interesting ones is Harris, because she doesn't have a huge spike at first and then kind of earns it and has a larger spike. I think she had a rally, which got really good turnout. But what do you make? So Harris like jumped up in the polls when she announced, but then recently has like kind of crept down a little bit, hasn't she? What do you make of that?
I think she's been hurt by Bernie announcing because Bernie added, you know, look, Bernie added like 5 or 6 points upon announcing and Beto added like 2 or 3. And so those kind of 8 points have to come from somewhere. And they seem to come from her more than other people. But look, I mean, she has a long way to go, but she's going to have the resources to do it and she can survive rough periods. I can't see like any scenario where she blows up. You know what I mean? Like I can imagine a scenario where Beto says something dumb and the cycle falls off a coffee counter or whatever, right? And like the kind of
a la Bob Dole.
But I don't think and I can imagine cases where Biden like totally flops. Like I don't think her bubble is gonna burst. She very well might wind up being a Marco Rubio-esque candidate who like it never quite clicks, right? And she has her 13% and never really gets above 13%. But I think she's gonna like have a fairly clear path toward the semifinals.
All right, Claire.
Okay.
Take it away.
Well, I think I've grouped mine in fours and there are obvious tiers to these candidates.
You only get one pick.
I know. I'm torn between two. Okay. I'm gonna go with O'Rourke. And I'm gonna say it.
Somebody just
I will not respond to you. So I'm going to go for my top tier pick with the idea that Democratic voters have expressed have expressed the desire that their candidate be competitive in the general election. I do think that that's a euphemism for a white man. And so of the top tier, there are three choices in my mind of white men: O'Rourke, Sanders, and Biden. I think Sanders is ultimately too divisive to people. I think Biden actually has a lot of potential to fall flat among people on the left, loud voices, activists. And I think O'Rourke has the potential, particularly in the early states, particularly Iowa, where Barack Obama basically made his campaign in that 07, 08 time period. I think that people will be nostalgic for that. And I think they'll say, listen, O'Rourke is young, Biden is too old, Sanders is too old. O'Rourke is a moderate, he can win. He can raise money. I think he's a pretty safe bet.
All right. Fair enough.
To argue with, yeah.
The thing about this is we can tell what the audience thinks by how they respond to the candidate. I think Harris got a better response than Beto O'Rourke so far. Is that right, audience?
There's already a Beto backlash. I think this is like...
But here's the thing. I think this audience is Twitter, and Twitter is not. No, I'm serious. I'm serious. I think that Beto actually plays probably pretty well out on the campaign trail.
To be clear, Claire meant that in a negative way. Okay. Third pick. So you guys have passed over the two people leading in Democratic primary polls. We've made that mistake
like a year
before.
Out.
We've made that mistake before, too. I'm going to select Biden. Former Vice President Joe Biden.
Very muted. Muted applause for those at home. Muted applause.
Joseph, that's pretty underwhelming, yeah.
Proof that this room is Twitter.
Yeah. No, I do think... So, okay, Biden is leading in early primary polls. He's not even in the race yet. That's a good sign. he also has, like, the best favorable ratings of all the candidates. That's a good sign. You know, he's more well-known, point taken. I do think that the path for Biden is pretty binary in the sense of, like, either he's going to be, you know, one of the two or three finalists and get a real big chunk of the Democratic vote or, like, totally flop out. And the chances that he flops are real. I mean, he's done it twice. but still, that he wasn't taking one or two is sort of... ridiculous and bad picks. So I'll take them three.
Mikey, you're the kind of person who would, like, in a Kentucky Derby pool, you'd like pick the favorite, you know? And that's no fun.
Yeah, I am that type of person.
I actually think Biden is a bigger gamble than you might think because I do think that I think that the Democratic primary base has changed a lot in the last couple of years. part of that is, I think, a scarring loss. Part of that is just some high-profile candidates who have won and brought new conversations to the mainstream. And either, I think you are right that Biden is a binary in some ways. Either he'll work or he won't. But I do think that once he gets into the campaign and there's actual coverage of him, it might be...
Yeah, totally.
I mean, to get to... But, like, look, there's also a scenario where this turns out to be really boring and that Biden just barrels through with 32%. And then the fact is that there are people on the left who dislike him, that, like, it's not that large a group. And his numbers against Trump are relatively decent, so he has the electability thing going. I mean, you know, so if it is hit or miss and you're betting on winner-take-all, then that's an argument for what Micah did.
Just get I'll let Galen go in a second, but... You know, the left of the Democratic Party eats up a lot of oxygen, and rightfully so in most ways. Like, that's where the party is moving. That's where a lot of the energy is. But I think people still don't appreciate how much of the party is still relatively moderate for the Democratic Party. So, like, left of center, you know, like, a third of Democratic primary voters are white voters without a college degree, which, according to polls, are sort of disproportionately in the Biden camp. Black voters overall are relatively moderate compared to the rest of the Democratic Party, and Biden does well with black voters in polls so far. A lot could change. But it's like, you know, I think people's mental models of the Democratic Party is like Sanders, AOC, and it really needs to be like Biden, Cory Booker, one part Sanders, something like that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I guess...
You get two picks.
I have an obvious pick for my first pick, and that will be Bernie Sanders. Oh, there we go. Who is, you know, second in the polls at the moment. And I would say I'm picking Bernie Sanders not because you are wrong about the majority of the party being left of center or relatively moderate. I think you're absolutely right. And I think all three of the people that y'all just picked can fight over all of those people. And Bernie Sanders' path to winning the nomination is just keeping the kind of cult-like support that he has from 2016.
Wait, Galen, who would you have picked if you had gone first, though?
If I had gone first, I would... No, that's too hard. I gotta stay focused.
Keep going, Galen.
I gotta stay focused. So y'all can divide up the rest of the field with Biden, Harris, Beto, and Bernie Sanders kind of glides to...
Sandals.
Bernie Sanders is a summer alter ego.
I could see him as like a Birkenstock kind of guy.
Oh, yeah. Goes to Jacob Reese.
Bernie and Birkenstock. Okay. So, yeah, Bernie Sanders has a Trump-like path to winning the nomination, which is that like 33% of the country loves him, shows up to all of his rallies, all turn out on primary day and vote for Bernie Sanders, and he wins the nomination. Okay.
I buy that. That's a real possibility here. I buy that argument.
I think it's a real possibility. However, by the way, Bernie Sanders sounds like some Hollywood producer who has like too much coke at his parties. And anyway,
does he like go to sandals resorts? Like, is that what's making you think of
Bernie
that? Because that doesn't sound like that to me.
I don't know.
Me.
It was just the image that pops in my head.
We've made it through one round.
By round three, it gets really weird.
If you had GOP primary rules where it's winner take all after a certain point, then I think Sanders would be in the conversation for number one overall. For what it's worth, I had him third.
So, like, not terrible, but, like, not great.
No, I think you got good value is what I'm saying.
Okay.
But, like, the fact that, like, I can easily see him holding on to that 20 or 25% or 28% or 30% or whatever that he has now. I think he'll probably do very well in both Iowa and New Hampshire, which is a nice set of attributes to have as a candidate. I'm not sure how he gets beyond that, meaning I don't mean that like, oh, I think he can't get beyond that. I'm saying like that's a big challenge, but yeah.
Well, so the next person in line when you look at the polling, I guess, is Elizabeth Warren, but because I'm going to make the argument that Bernie Sanders has this support that will eat up all of the left and help propel him to the nomination, I'm going to skip over Elizabeth Warren. Think I'm going to pick Cory Booker.
I want
muted that. Applause, muted applause. The reason I'll pick Cory Booker as my second choice, the overall fifth choice on the board, is because, one, I think he's not at the front of people's minds right now. So as the campaign wears on and the three people that y'all picked, the campaign turns into like a slugfest and there's a lot of negative you know, campaigning. Cory Booker's going to kind of like sit back in his Newark, New Jersey positivity. He's going to keep his favorability ratings relatively high.
We always associate positivity with New Jersey. That's good old New Jersey.
Did you see that documentary? Anyway. Yeah, and I think that...
He'll get a big bump from his wedding to Rosario Dawson.
Yeah, exactly. But really, I think another legitimate reason is that part of why you picked Biden is because I think he reminds a lot of people of Obama, and Obama is still extraordinarily popular in the Democratic Party. And, you know, like, let's be real, I think when people see Cory Booker and see his kind of retail politics and the fact that he's an African-American man who talks about positivity and hope and being able to, like, change the country through those kinds of qualities, we know that Democrats liked that. We know that they still like it, that they still identify with it, so that's why I pick Cory Booker.
He's a solid second-tier pick, I think. I think that's right.
Like, thank you.
But I think that he does, just the obvious thing to point out, is that he and Harris have been competing a little bit for endorsements from African-American lawmakers. So there's, and he's, I think Nate's point is probably right that she's a bit stronger with the full coalition. And so he struggles a bit on that level, I think, going out a year from now.
Fair enough. All right, we got to
pick up
start motoring through our second-tier candidates. Micah, you next.
I'm going to pick Elizabeth Warren. More applause than the Booker pick, I'll note. Better favorables than Booker. Real solid on policy. Is sort of right where I think you want to be policy-wise in terms of the Democratic Party. To be clear, she has really good favorables among Democrats. Her favorables overall, which I mentioned earlier, are not great. But, you know, if, like, Democrats want a really solid progressive who represents the party, Warren's a pretty good pick. I think there will be at some point, just like there's been, like, a Beto backlash. I think at some point the like, media counterintuitive countertake will come around to Warren's benefit. So, yeah, so... That's my second pick.
Cool.
All right. Claire, you're up next.
Okay. I'm going to take Amy Klobuchar as my pick for the second round.
I kind of thought this would be like an Amy Klobuchar crowd. I don't know why I thought that.
The Klob. I call her the Klob.
It's unfortunate. Were you going to pick her?
Yeah.
You love her. I think she's a good value candidate. Again, I am betting on the Democratic Party going with a quote-unquote safer bet. She is a woman. She is a white woman. She is a moderate from the Midwest, which the Democrats famously, the upper Midwest, no less, which the Democrats didn't do particularly well with in 2016, I think, as a lot of people remember. I think the salad throwing or whatever thing will...
Those are mixed up. It was a binder throwing and salad eating with a comb.
I think those things will continue to exist throughout the campaign. It'll be a problem for her, but it might be something... I mean, they've already sort of tried to spin it to her advantage a little bit. She's a mom, so she was being ingenious with...
Thrifty,
eating with a comb. Anyway, I think that she's... her performance in Minnesota in the last election was very good, particularly with white voters, I believe. I think Nathaniel Rakich pointed out that she does have a weakness among minority voters, which is obviously a big coalition in the Democratic Party. But I think Klobuchar is a pretty good choice, if I do say so.
Yeah, I was
All right, Nate.
See, I was worried about getting the 8-9
drop-off here.
Because these are like, after these seven, you run out of candidates who are... getting continuous media coverage.
I know
coverage.
Who you're going to pick, though.
Well, yeah.
So I'm just going to go with my pick. With candidates who I think have the most talent, because at some point... What?
Nothing.
At some point, I'm just talking to Claire about who you're going to pick. We know who you're going to pick.
We know who you're going to pick.
You
I don't know which order.
So you want to say it on three,
and,
Claire?
I have 8 and 9. So yeah. Them both or one at a time?
One at a time.
Yeah.
All right. I will take Pete Buttigieg.
We know. Oh, my goodness! Wait.
Okay, so... Okay.
Wait, really?
Wow. NYU's,
wait,
NYU's English Lit
up.
Department really turned out tonight. Shout out to the Finnegan's Wake study group. We're glad you guys all made it tonight.
What's going on?
Because he is he offers, to be frank, like he offers like some of what Beto offers from something optimistic, right, and from the middle part of the country, but with, frankly, a lot more substance. And so,
I'm like genuinely amazed.
Yeah,
at
I'm.
This.
Are we being like punked?
But and you do hear again, like we're beyond the top seven. I think there's a pretty clear cutoff after seven,
yeah.
Right? But like, he is someone who you hear people talking about as like someone who they kind of like, and they don't think anyone else does. Well, it's March, and there's plenty of time for candidates like that to have their opportunity on the debate stage.
I agree. He's someone who I think is doing the right thing in running, even though I don't think he'll win, because I think he's either a really viable vice presidential candidate or he's just propelling himself to bigger state office, whatever. I think he, and he, by the way, he's been doing this since 2016. This started in 2016 when he ran for DNC chair. He had some pretty, well-known professionals running his campaign. Like, Pete Buttigieg is an incredibly smart person. I'd probably put him as like one of the top two smartest people running for president right now. If we're going to rank people.
We shouldn't.
Let's rank by IQ, right?
No, yeah. Let's not
do
that, IQ please.
Fine, he's in the top five. But I think he's someone who's obviously incredibly talented. He's obviously very career-focused. I mean, this person has, he's made, how old is he, 37?
He's like 37.
Yeah, like he's done quite a bit, quite intentionally in a very short time. So he's someone who I think is doing the right thing and running for president right now at a young age.
With pick number nine, I will take someone who I think may not run, but if she did, would be formidable, which is Stacey Abrams.
At nine, wow.
But look, I am not hugely optimistic about this kind of third tier of candidates that you all will have to pick from. And I think some of them are on the verge of maybe having flopped, or I don't know, right? But like, she is someone who, look, Beto got a big, huge bounce in interest during the midterm. And granted, because there is stuff about like race and gender and coverage, like had like background, but kind of faded from the scene and came back out and was a big story again. You know, I do think Stacey Abrams would be a big deal. I think her coalition is very intriguing. It is like a little bit of the AOC coalition, where you get younger voters, you get African Americans, you get the left. I just think she's kind of really well situated for kind of what the Democratic Party is now, and I think she's very talented.
We gotta motor along.
So right, we'll
we
correct.
Are going to. You get like two sentences
okay.
with your
I can do that.
Third round pick.
My third round pick is Kirsten Gillibrand, because she's still a U.S. senator. Maybe she'll see a comeback with her constituency, which is basically women, potentially rural voters. Is that quick enough?
Yeah.
That's pretty freaking quick. I'll go Jay Inslee, governor of Washington.
All the environmentalists out there.
Yeah, has a clear issue, is running for a reason that could catch on. Probably won't, though. Sorry.
So the next name I'm going to say is because I really just want to know whether or not we're being punked, so I just want to hear what the crowd response is. We're going to go with
it.
Marianne Williamson.
Marianne Williamson.
No, we're not being punked. It looks like we're not being punked.
All right, and your second one.
My second one is going to be Julian Castro, which really obviously should have come before Marianne Williamson. But, you can make obvious arguments about, like, the demographic that he can appeal to, which is Hispanic voters. You know, that's obviously true for a party that wants to try to increase turnout amongst Hispanic voters. But also, we know him to be a somewhat talented retail politician. We don't think he's going to win, but let's just move on.
I kind of want to do a pick just to block Claire from picking him. Look, I'm going to go Hickenlooper.
Damn it. I like beer, Senator.
It's like, at this level, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's who I was actually going to pick. I'll go with Tim Ryan.
I do. Claire loves Tim Ryan.
Because I have to pick him every single time now. Tim Ryan is trying to be what Sherrod Brown would have been in this race, which is he's a rep from Ohio. He's a traditional Rust Belt Democrat who wrote a book about mindfulness. So he's trying to play into a little bit of the, I guess, millennial urban demographic and the party's base. He's also probably running to get more national attention to run for something else. But that's my pick.
All right, Nate, you only have one pick.
There's only one way to close this out, and it's with Andrew Yang. I mean, he and Mayor Pete are the two candidates who have kind of emerged virally from the internet. And we're not getting, like, very much...
Nate's favorite place.
Yeah. We're not getting very much attention at all, and, like, all of a sudden, like, he is getting, like, more search traffic than, like, Cory Booker. He has raised, I think, more money than Gillibrand. Again, I don't know quite how he goes from, like, the very enthusiastic support of a corner of the internet to winning the Democratic nomination, but I'm not sure how John Hickenlooper goes from 0.3% in the polls to winning the Democratic nomination either. And so maybe just in the spirit of, like, talk about, like, kind of who the hell knows what's going to happen. And, like, I guess I do have, like, a lot of people here who are not traditionally well-credentialed. So I guess I am kind of making an argument that, like, Democrats might not want a Trump, who was a big celebrity candidate. Like, I thought the Mark Cuban, Michael Avenatti picks never made sense. But, like, the fact that maybe someone from a background that doesn't involve electoral politics, and by the way, a lot of the Democrats who did well in the midterms in 2018, not so much for the Senate, but certainly for races for the House, where people are like, hey, this is just an interesting person who decided to run for the House and is actually like a normal person that like that won a House seat or something. So I'm on team.
Those are two outsider. Long run-on sentences.
A poll came out today. It was either today or yesterday, and it asked Democratic voters like what they want in a candidate. And one of like the top most popular characteristics was like decades of political experience. Literally, it said decades of political experience. Which would seem to rule out Andrew Yang.
All right. Well, now the audience gets to vote overall. So we're going to go down the line. And according to your applause, we're going to figure out who won this installment of our 2020 Democratic primary draft. So Nate Silver, who's voting for Nate Silver? I like, you know, if I wasn't playing, I might have voted for Nate. But okay.
This Claire. Is a biased.
Nate's is like the internet's team.
Yeah. Yeah. That is it. Yeah.
Mine's the world's, the country's team. The country.
All right. Claire Malone, ladies and gentlemen. Muted applause, muted applause.
Polite applause, yeah.
Micah Cohen's team. And my team? Okay. Basically, 1, 2, 3, 4, it looks like.
Oh, fair I think. Okay. Okay. Let's not argue about it. That's not a great look.
No, you guys, I won. All right, that's a wrap for today's podcast. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Micah. And thanks to all of you in the audience. And of course, thank you to the NYU Scribble Center for hosting us and to WeWork for sponsoring us. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow, Vanessa Diaz, and Mina Gannison are all in control rooms or off stage somewhere helping us out this evening. So thank you so much to them and a big round of applause to them. We also want to thank Stephanie Roos, Amber Gardner, and Olivia Knotts for helping set this all up. It's been fantastic. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store, or just tell a friend about us. You know, we plan to have more news about more live shows coming out soon, so stay tuned. And thanks again for listening, and we will see you soon.